Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Our news is filled with the stories of the pious, the righteous, the religious, and the right. Most of humanity understands the need to let the sacred express itself in its own mysterious ways. But this week, in Alaska, a sudden act, a shot, and another victim falls to the war on wonder. A wolf is dead, and a howl is heard in the hearts of many who beg for mercy for the gentle beings. The voice rings out here on the Wildside News when we return to the story of the Talklat Wolves. This week, an alpha male was shot when he crossed the invisible boundary of safety. The leader of the legendary Talklat Wolf Pack, which had carried on the legacy of this great tribe of animals in the sanctuary of Denali National Park, drawn to the sight of his alpha mate, who had died in a trap a few weeks back. For over 50 years, this Talklat Pack has been studied, photographed, filmed, and most amazingly, thrilled visitors to the park, who would, when lucky, share a road or a trail with these wolves that chose to share their territory with the two-legged beasts. For nearly 40 years, a dedicated wildlife researcher has followed their lives from the air, on foot, and in his research. This week may mark the end of his work, for with the death of this, the last alpha wolf, the Talklat wolves may drift apart forever, victims again of this war on wonder. Joining me now from Anchorage, Alaska, is Dr. Gordon Haber, who is an independent wildlife scientist who's been studying wolves and wolf prey systems for 40 years, since 1966, in Alaska. Dr. Haber, welcome to the Wildside News.
It's good to be here.
Now, your name is in the news quite a bit right now because of some recent events that are really quite shocking to many people who follow wolves and animals and behavior and populations and things happening all over the planet, and this has to do with the wolf population that's associated with Denali National Park. Give us the news that is so critical right now.
Well, the Talklat family lineage of wolves has been around since I started there in 1966 doing research on them, and actually Adolf Murray, the famous naturalist, was still in Denali when I arrived, and he died a couple years later, but he told me that that was the same group that he had made famous in his classic monograph, The Wolves of Mount McKinley, from his 1939 through 41 studies. He had continued informal observations during the interim, and when I arrived, he said, well, that's just what you're looking at now, it's just later generations. So I know from my own research that this group goes back 40 years, and based on what he told me, which is certainly reliable, it's probably older than 65 years. So what makes that so unusual is that you can count on one hand in the entire planet wild vertebrate societies that go back anything comparable to that length in time in terms of their age. I believe Jane Goodell has a chimpanzee troop in the Gombe Reserve in Africa that has been around for something comparable to that. I think there's a well-known pod of orcas off the northwest coast of North America, and there may be a pride of lions, if my memory serves me correctly, in Africa. That's maybe 20, 30 years that we know of. But this is clearly, if not the oldest known family lineage of any non-human social species in the wild. It sits right up there within the top two or three. And that gives it the enormous scientific value. I mean, it gives you an opportunity to learn, a rare opportunity to learn a whole lot about what makes a successful vertebrate society tick. And this group was hit hard here, starting in February, by trapping just outside the boundary, 100 to 200 feet outside the boundary of Denali National Park. First of all, the alpha female is trapped, and then another key female is trapped. And to make a long story short, her mate, the breeding male, the alpha male, just kind of turned very erratic in his behavior after that. He kind of left the six young on their own. He abandoned the territory and started moving very erratically in distant areas. And to make a long story short, he got shot himself way outside the park here recently. And There was another female, probably a two-year-old, that he mated with on March 9th. I watched that. That was after his first mate was trapped. They were in the same trapping area, and some things happened, and they got separated. She's been on her own ever since then, too, and currently is, as of a couple of days ago, is 25 miles west of the established territory. So all we have left of this famous, extremely valuable group at this point, at least as of 2 days ago, is the six young wolves. Most of them are pups of the year, born in May of 2004. Might be one or two of those that are two-year-olds. They're hard to tell apart right now. And they're on their own, still in a group as of this Sunday, the 24th. And then this one pregnant female who's still 25 miles away, totally on her own. That's all we have left of this formerly extremely cohesive, fascinating, and extremely valuable group.
One of the things that made this particular group so notable was the fact that they had developed, and unfortunately this led perhaps to the demise, they were really quite friendly with people. They weren't really frightened by people and airplanes and buses and things, and therefore many, many, many people had the opportunity to see these wolves up close. They've been probably photographed more than any other wolf pack in the history of the world.
When I talk about this group being around for 40 years, the continuity that has made them so valuable, it's a combination of genetic and social continuity. It's a combination of the two. There's traditions that span generations, for example, in the way they use certain den sites, certain hunting routes, certain travel routes, certain hunting areas, the way they move between different dens in the summer. There's some very specific patterns. Some of their hunting methods themselves have been carried on across generations. So there's a kind of a dual information transfer, both genetic and social, and that's what I mean when I talk about a family lineage. It's not just a genetic continuity, it's the combination. So with that in mind, yes, they have over the years developed a lot of ability to be seen by people easily in the park, but that's primarily a function of their use of dens, specific dens and hunting routes and so forth in the summer that are within the road corridor of Denali National Park, where there's a lot of open terrain. There's this common sort of belief that these wolves are habituated, and I differ with that view. Virtually every biologist in the business, and even myself up till a few years ago, had that view. And now I believe it's completely wrong. What these wolves do, and what wolves do in other areas also, not just these wolves, in other areas of Denali, their natural behavior is more akin to fearlessness, not fearfulness. The wolves don't really fear anything. You see them acting very bold around moose and bears and everything else. There's no particular reason to expect they should be just fearful of people. And you combine that with their high intelligence, which far exceeds anything of the most intelligent dog you've ever known. It's not hard to understand how wolves arrive in the park, and this actually happens from trapping areas, and within days or weeks, not even months, they're behaving the same way and tolerating people the same way as wolves that have been there for years. It's not a slow process like you sort of expect when you normally think of habituation, nor are they fixating on people as you expect in a true habituation process, and there's no food conditioning involved. Their lack of fear of people is really a lot closer to their natural behavior than the fearfulness. That's something they have to learn when they go out into trapping areas, and they learn that. And unfortunately, though, the only opportunity wolves sometimes have when they leave the park and go outside to learn fearfulness from trapping and hunting, they get one chance, and then it's too late. I mean, they run into a hunter trapper, and they're dead.
I would have thought that it was a process of habituation.
I would have thought the same thing, and until a few years ago, there's too much that happened. For example, his alpha male had just showed up. He came from the most heavily trapped area in the state, and within, I don't know, a week or two, he was just as tolerant of people as wolves that had been there for many years.
This concept that it isn't a matter of habituation, that it is in reality just sort of a natural dynamic of their, they're sharing the space with us, and we happen to be there, but that's okay.
There's an awful lot. You know, I used to believe it was habituation too, but there's just been too much happening in recent years with turnovers and some other groups of wolves in the park where new wolves have appeared from some of, and even this alpha male at the that was just killed. When he appeared in the park, he came from one of the most heavily trapped areas in the state, and yet within days or a couple of weeks, certainly not even a month, he was acting just as tolerant, and I know that my own personal observations of them as wolves that have been around for for years and years.
Well, this is a type of a topic that we could go on literally for days. Some people would say, well, okay, so we've lost some more wolves, but there's plenty of wolves in Alaska, and the fact that this particular pack of wolves is now, or family of wolves, whatever you want to call it, is almost essentially gone. This legacy is over. They'll be replaced. But quite honestly, I think what you're bringing to this is the important message that it goes way beyond just a matter of populations, that it really has to do with these individuals, their family dynamics, this, which is what you've been focusing on for so long. Boy, give us some of your thoughts on that.
Well, you make a good point there, and this view that populations are all that matter, and therefore that the loss of Tokwa is no big deal. You know, you may be shocked, or some of your listeners may be shocked to hear that right now is the line of the National Park Service up here in Alaska, too. And one of the reasons those wolves weren't protected where they should have been is much because of opposition from the National Park Service as the state. You know, wolf biology is based primarily on two major evolutionary strategies, both of which are pretty uncommon in among vertebrates, pretty rare. Cooperative hunting and cooperative breeding. And this implies all kinds of close interdependencies, interrelationships among family groups, not across populations. So the preeminent functional unit in wolf biology is the family unit. It's not a population. I mean, when the Park Service up in Alaska and the state people, and these are biologists, mind you, that say this, when they over and over again insist that, oh, well, it's no big deal, we still got a good population across the whole 6,000 square miles, that's just utter nonsense, because for one thing, I mean, technically the population of which the Denali wolves are a part stretches hundreds of miles clear to the Arctic Ocean. You could kill every last wolf in Denali, and that population wouldn't still be in danger just in terms of its numerical status. So there would be no point at which these people, including the Park Service, would argue that there's ever any reason to do anything to protect wolves in Denali.
Wolf behavior, this concept, the reality of the family nature of wolves is totally fascinating. I think it's one of the reasons that those people who have spent time studying wolves become fascinated with the way in which they get along, because it's not a simple process. It's very complex. Give us an insight into the nature of the wolf family.
Well, there are different versions of wolf families, of course, and even Toklat, this group, one of the values in studying a single group over a long period of time is that you get a chance to see what, you know, how it can change over time, and that's exactly what's happened with Toklat. Early on in my study, this group was afforded very large numbers of caribou. When there were a lot of caribou, this group had a much looser type of social structure, and now, to make a long story short, the prey situation for this group has changed, and they're dependent much more on moose, for example, now, and mountain sheep, which have a much more dependable season-to-season presence. And this is reflected in a much more stable, more cohesive type of social structure. There are still multiple litters in certain years. As recently as 1990, that group had three, maybe even four litters. I found at least three. And just this past year, the established family group had six pups, and out of the clear blue in midsummer, I saw a young female show up, totally unrelated. I knew she was unrelated just because of her color. It had no relationship to this group at all or any neighboring groups. And she just showed up, looked like a yearling, and I never saw the alpha pair assert much dominance over her. Their yearlings and two-year-olds did. But within a few days, she just literally took over and became the primary attendant, by far, of the six new pups, and just watched over them like a hawk while she was at the den, which, of course, meant that she was harassed by them often. That was a penalty to pay when you have to be close to pups at that age. And she hunted for them regularly, brought food back, regurgitated regularly for them. She when she first showed up, she was skinny as a rail. Obviously, hadn't eaten very much and was in really lousy-looking shape. Within just a couple of weeks, she filled right out and was just doing great. So there was kind of a two-way gain there. She obviously gained, but then having that kind of a close attendant, unusually close, throughout the summer as she remained, and right up until when she was trapped in February with the pups, I mean, they obviously gained, and therefore the group gained genetically and so forth.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's right that it is only the alpha male and female that are successful breeders?
Well, no, it varies all over the place, and in this particular group, that's by no means been the rule of thumb. In some years it is, but there have been about a third of the years where I could make that determination. There's been multiple litters in this particular group up until now. As I say, two litters is fairly common, sometimes three. In one year, I think there was even four.
Now, is that with between the alpha male and other females, or is it different?
Most of the evidence is that it's separate males, but I have seen cases of polygyny, and one in just in 1990, in 2002, with this same group, where the alpha male at that time in 2001, the well-established alpha male, was killed during some careless radio collaring on the part of a biologist doing work for the Park Service, and a month later, by pure coincidence, this alpha male that was just killed, he showed up. He came from my other study area, 200 miles away. He came from a group that I had been studying over there.
That's amazing.
And he came by way of a sterilization wolf control project the state was implementing at the time, where they were in that particular area. They were going in and just devastating all, ripping up these groups and taking out all the individuals and dumping them off hundreds of miles away and then sterilizing the remaining male and female. And this was one of the wolves that had been dumped off with a sib 300 miles from where he came from in my other study area. And then by pure coincidence, he then came from that location 200 miles to the south and ended up plop right within a mile of the den of this female who had just a month earlier lost her established mate from this radio collaring thing. And she had already been pregnant from him, and so now she had his young. They just emerged at the den, and this one of her older offspring, this female that was trapped this past February, apparently bonded with this new male and his sib right away, and she literally brought him back to the den. Her mother didn't want anything to do with him, but it was through the repeated efforts of her daughter that he was able to stay, and within a couple of weeks, he just took the group right over and actually started raising the unrelated young, just like they were his own. Now, these are the former alpha male genes. Why would he do that? Well, clearly these pups in the established group was benefiting from his presence because he was obviously helping to enhance the survival of these young pups. Now, where would his gain be? Well, you know, there would, of course, be a good chance that he would end up mating with one of the females the next breeding season in the following March and have his own young. And in wolf society, it turns out yearlings are extremely important to the success of new pups. They typically are the closest attendants of the pups. Pups from earlier years attend the new pups more closely than the parents even do. And so having yearlings around really does enhance the success of your future genes if you're about to mate. And so, of course, the potential payoff for him, the other end of the, you know, reciprocity deal here would be in increasing the likelihood of propagating his own genes the very next breeding season. Well, that's exactly what happened. He ended up mating with this young female who had brought him back to the den, and her mother as well. That female, the mother that he ended up mating with, along with the daughter, she ended up disassociating voluntarily from the group a few weeks later, which really surprised me. She never left the territory. She stayed within the territory, but just didn't associate with the rest of the group anymore, and ended up having his young. She went back to the den that she used the first year, her and her former mate, and she went back to that den to have this new batch of young, but she had been doing very poorly on her own, and we know from necropsy that she had two pups, but they never survived. By mid-July, I actually watched her die. She starved to death.
But that really talks as well about the complexity of the whole matrix of wolf populations, that she became, in essence, a lone wolf. And that's not necessarily a good thing to be in a population
of wolves. And that was proved by the fact she starved a couple of months later. Pair bonds are extremely close in wolf society, every bit as much so in human society, and every bit as variable.
The story of the Talk Rat Wolves continues when we return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News. We'll be right back.